you're looking for a thriller to read, Brad Meltzer has a suggestion. He's the author of a stack of best-selling thrillers. It's no surprise, then, that one of his favorite books is in that same genre. Here's Brad Meltzer with his pick for our series, You Must Read This.
When I was 19 years old, oy, I already sound like an old man. But that's the point. When I was 19, my dreams were even bigger than my hair, which is saying something. And it was in the midst of those dreams that I first read the novel Replay by Ken Grimwood. Replay has a simple premise. In chapter one, the main character, a 43-year-old man, sits at his desk and drops dead of a heart attack. When he wakes up, he feels odd, taking in familiar old smells, old sights, and he realizes he's back in college in his freshman dorm room. He's 18 again, with all the memories of his 43-year-old life. He gets, as the title says, to replay his life. And this time, he's no dummy. He doesn't marry the wife he knows he'd one day divorce. He bets on the 69 Mets and makes a ton of cash. He's rich and rich and rich. And he turns 43, drops dead, again. When he wakes up, he's now in his junior year of college. And this time he realizes that money doesn't matter as much as he thought. So he lives a different life until he turns 43, dead, again. When he wakes up, he's now in his 20s. The space between death is shrinking. And he keeps dying. But what cracks the book wide open is when the main character is flipping through the newspaper one day and sees a classified ad that says, "If you know who Lee Harvey Oswald is, call me." This is pre-1963. And the hero of Replay now realizes he's not the only one out there reliving his life. But the best part of Replay isn't the plot. The best part is that the book is about you. Yes, you. The moment Ken Grimwood has his authory hooks in you, you can't help but look at your own life. You can't help but think, what would I do differently if I could live my life again? What would I do differently? But by the time the hero lives his bohemian life in Paris, still not the perfect life, you realize this book isn't a thriller. It's an instruction manual. You should never live your life looking backward. You live your life by going forward. So how much do I love this book? When I was 22 years old, I worked at Games Magazine. I had no money, a $359 apartment, and $10,000 in college debt. And the first thing I did with all the cash I didn't have? I tried to track down Ken Grimwood and buy the movie rights for this book. I didn't just love Replay. I believed in it. I dreamed of it. I wanted this book that only I had found. And that's when his agent told me the film rights had been snatched up years ago. Years later, when I first found Google, I again found myself searching for Ken Grimwood. That's when I found that he died in 2003. And when I also realized I wasn't his only believer. At the time, there were fan sites dedicated to Replay. Hundreds of people, like the fellow replayers we never realize are out there, all of them dreaming my same dream. But as any true believer or replayer knows, there's a strange, odd power in knowing you're not alone in this world.
Brad Meltzer is a best-selling author, most recently of The Book of Lies. He lives in Florida. The recommendation you just heard was the novel Replay by Ken Grimwood. For more You Must Read This recommendations, you can go to our website. That's at npr.org.
Robert B. Parker doesn't like to embellish the truth. So when he talks about Boston, he doesn't romanticize the city where Spencer, his fictional private eye, solves crimes. Parker says Boston is the backdrop for his Spencer books because it's the city he knows best. To begin our series, Crime in the City, NPR's Lynn Neary spent some time with the crime writer in his hometown.
Robert B. Parker Spencer is not your typical private eye. Oh, sure, he's tough, an ex-cop and a boxer who's no stranger to violence. And he can deliver a stinging one-liner with the best of them. But he's no brooding loner with something to hide. Spencer enjoys life. He likes good food and wine. He's got a dog named Pearl and a sidekick named Hawk. And the thing that really sets him apart from other fictional detectives is his long-term relationship with Susan Silverman, a psychologist with a PhD from Harvard. They've been through a lot, even separated for a while. And though they don't live together, they are committed to each other. So it's not surprising to learn that Robert B. Parker's Boston begins at home with his wife, Joan.
Oh, and there she is, girl of my dreams.
The Parkers have been together for a long time.
A long, 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 long time. 58 years. We've been married 52.
The Parkers have spent their entire married life in the Boston area. Their current home is a beautiful Victorian on a pretty street in Cambridge, just across the river from Boston. They moved here in the 80s after a brief separation. They realized they still wanted to be together, but with a slightly different living arrangement.
Which is simply to say that I have my space and Bob has his space. Actually, Bob has a bedroom and an office, and I consider the whole rest of the house mine.
The arrangement seems to suit them, and certainly for Robert Parker, it's been better than living without his wife. He believes he could live in and write about any city, as long as she is there.
There's a conceit that place matters more, I think, to a writer than it does. I think if Raymond Chandler had lived in Chicago, Marlowe would still be Marlowe. And I think if I lived in Cincinnati and Spencer would then be working in Cincinnati, he'd probably still be Spencer because I'd probably still be me. Because what makes me is much more to do with her, who I assume would be living with me in Cincinnati.
Not so much.
We won't put it to the test.
Well, that's not to say that Robert Parker doesn't like Boston, because he does. And he has a Bostonian's healthy sense of humor about living in Cambridge in the shadow of Harvard University. Parker likes to joke that Cambridge is located across the river from Boston to provide the city with comic relief. And driving around Harvard Square, he takes delight in pointing out some of his neighbor's eccentricities.
Hey, doggy with a backpack, that is, how Cambridge is that?
What is Spencer's take on Harvard and Cambridge?
He makes fun of it. There's a shock.
Spencer spends some time in Cambridge because that's where Susan lives, but Spencer's home is across the river in Boston's Back Bay neighborhood.
Do you want to see Spencer's abode?
Absolutely.
The townhouse where Spencer lives really does exist. It's a four-story brownstone on Marlborough Street, just around the corner from Boston's Public Garden, one of the city's biggest tourist attractions. A short distance away is the office building where Spencer works.
This building on the right with the spires, That's where Spencer's office is.
What is the office like?
Desk in the bay window there where he sits with his back to the window. File cabinet. A big couch for his necking with Susan and for Pearl to sleep on when she visits.
So does the Boston that Spencer lives in and works in that office, is it the same Boston that we're driving through now, or is it a Boston of your imagination?
Both. It is the Boston we're driving through now filtered through my imagination and the needs of my book. I don't lie, but I sometimes... invent places that aren't there. You know, if I want them to have a terrible meal in a restaurant for some reason, I don't use a real restaurant because why, you know, badmouth somebody.
But if he's going to have a good meal.
When he has a good meal, it's at a real place.
And what better place than the Bristol Lounge at the Four Seasons Hotel. Just a block from Spencer's office, the Bristol Lounge is one of Spencer's and Parker's favorites. The book Sudden Mischief opens in the Bristol Lounge, with Susan and Spencer listening to the pianist play Green Dolphin Street. And sometimes, Spencer likes to sit at the bar with his pal Hawk, nursing a scotch. Spencer, says Parker, knows how to live life well.
Anything Spencer undertakes, he's reasonably thorough and competent at. So if he's going to eat, he tries to eat well. If he's going to have a drink, he tries to drink something good. If he's going to date a woman, it may as well be Susan.
Parker makes no apologies for placing his character in one of Boston's upscale neighborhoods. He's not especially interested in exploring the dark side or the gritty streets of his city. If he were a private eye, Parker says, he'd also have his office in Back Bay, in close proximity to the public garden, where Boston's famous swan boats glide across a small pond.
Swan boats have been doing this for, I don't know, 1840 or something like that. Long time.
We take a seat on one of the benches that line the pond and watch as the swan boats float quietly by.
They sit here a lot, and Spencer and whoever on the bench, and discuss stuff. That little bridge is an excellent place for meeting bad guys and things. A lot of stuff happens on that bridge, partly because it's open and you can see from both sides and no ambushes are possible and all the things you'd worry about if you were a bad guy.
But, you know, sitting here, it just seems so idyllic. It's hard to imagine that bad things would be going on here.
One of the aspects of Renaissance painting was that they would always put death in the picture, as you'd paint some landscape and death would be in a corner there. And I think that the more idyllic and pastoral the environment, the more the non-pastoral, non-idyllic stands out. So I like the contrast sometimes. But no, it's bad things don't happen here much, except in my books.
Parker remains convinced that he could have placed Spencer in any city. But at this point, Spencer will never leave Boston because Parker will never leave. Boston is home, and home is what is most important to Parker. Lynn Neary, NPR News.
And you can read lines like, "He turned and gave me the hard eye," on our website, npr.org. That's an excerpt from Robert B. Parker's book, Now and Then. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
The Forger's Spell is a new book that tells, quote, a true story of the greatest art hoax of the 20th century. It's the story of a man named Han van Meegeren, a Dutch painter of limited ability, who made a fortune as a forger, inventing unknown paintings, supposedly by Jan Vermeer, the renowned 17th century artist. Edward Dolnick, an award-winning writer of books about art crime, sets this story in the years leading up to the Second World War. It ends with the unmasking of the forger and the people he fooled, including the second most powerful man in Nazi Germany, Hermann Göring. Mr. Dolnick joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Well, thanks very much.
Your forger, Han van Meegeren, he tried his hand at imitating Frans Hals and other Dutch painters, but he decided to make a career of Vermeer, if you'll excuse the rhyme. Why?
There were a couple of reasons to focus on Vermeer. One was that he was just about the greatest brand name of them all. In art, this is the equivalent of Rolls-Royce or Tiffany or something. If you can get away with Vermeer, that shows how terrific you are, and it's where the money is. And in addition to all that, Vermeer was a painter whose biography is almost a complete blank to us. That left lots of elbow room to fill in the gaps as you saw fit, because nobody knew what the real story was.
It's also true, isn't it, that he didn't paint very many pictures. So there were only, today, only about 35 or 36 of them.
That's right. There are hardly any Vermeers in the world. Rembrandt, say, painting at more or less the same time, paints about 10 times as many pictures. And that's typical. So for art historians, one of the great questions is, where are all the others?
When he decided to go for Vermeer, he did do a lot of research, a lot of experimentation on canvases and paints and aging things. Now, I have one word for you here, Dolnick: plastics.
One of the terrific fun things in this story was that the forgery he got away with, the Vermeer that made his fortune, which sold for millions of dollars, it was supposed to look like a painting made in about 1670, something like that. But the forger, as you say, couldn't get paint that looked right until he discovered that if he used plastic, if he dissolved a little plastic in with his other stuff, that let him get away with it. Because what he needed was to make paint that would look old, which means that it had to be dry.
You could, for example, in a modern oil painting, you could press your fingernail into some blob of paint and probably make a dent.
It would give a little, and it would give not just for a week or a month, but for years. And to fully harden, it would take decades for an oil painting. So the great challenge for van Meegeren was to make a painting that was really only 3 months old act as if it were 3 centuries old. So what he does is goes out and buys a pizza oven. And time after time, what happened is that the paints burned up or melted. It didn't look good at all. Plastic was the answer to that problem. So it would harden, but not lose its brightness, its life.
Van Meegeren painted a number of very close copies of Vermeer's style. Tiny pictures with lots of rich fabrics, lovely clear blues, bright yellows, the light coming from the left, all of the things that we associate with Vermeer. But then he didn't have any success with those. Some of the prettiest ones he didn't even try to sell, because he decided that what he had to do was something that was completely different. And you call this in the book the uncanny valley. Could you explain that?
What he learned was that if you come close to getting an imitation just right, the closer you come for a while, the more convincing people find it. But when you get super close, almost all the way there, but not quite, At that point, people begin to look closer, and suddenly they focus not on how close this imitation is to the real thing, but on the last little gap that keeps it from being real. The experts would focus on the difference between the forgery and the real thing. What turned out to be a much better strategy for Van Meegeren was to make a painting that had a few hints of Vermeer, but wasn't like any of the known Vermeers, and then let the experts fill in the gaps themselves. Let them say, aha, didn't I always tell you that Vermeer had much more to him than you thought? It's not all ladies reading letters. It's sometimes completely different paintings, like this new one we've just found.
He painted a whole series of pictures in the same style and discovered more Vermeers. And one of the most famous was Christ and the Women Taken in Adultery, and that was a major triumph because of who it fooled.
At this point, no Vermeers, or essentially no Vermeers, had turned up in centuries. All of a sudden, they're turning up practically every 6 months. And the collectors want in on this game. And one of the biggest and greediest collectors of the day was Hermann Göring, the number two man in Nazi Germany, astonishing brute and megalomaniac and bully, who also fancies himself an art connoisseur. He gets a Van Meegeren Vermeer. He doesn't know, of course, it's a forgery. He thinks it's the real thing. He actually doesn't pay cash. He transfers 137 other paintings that he's looted. This is all during World War II, so he can grab whatever he wants. He takes looted paintings, trades 137 of them for this one Vermeer, which is going to become one of the jewels of his collection.
There's something else that seems incredible to me. This forger, Han van Meegeren, he died a hero.
At war's end, the Allies had caught up with Göring's art collection, tens of thousands of pictures, including this Vermeer. And the Nazis were meticulous with their paperwork when it came to art, as with everything else. And so the paperwork associated with Göring's prize Vermeer listed on it the name Han van Meegeren. It wasn't a name anyone recognized. And the police come knocking on van Meegeren's door, and they say that they have only a couple of questions to ask. They expect it will be purely routine. And the question is, please clear up for us how it was that your name came up in the sale of a Vermeer. And to the astonishment of the police, Van Meegeren doesn't have a very good answer. The great trouble for Van Meegeren as a forger was that he fooled one too many. He fooled Hermann Göring, and that brought all kinds of inspection. Most forgers fool one person too few. That's what does them in. Someone says, wait a minute, this is wrong. That never happened with Van Meegeren. What happened with him was this mix-up with Göring, which brought the authorities on the run.
When they determined that he had managed to fool this incredibly repellent Nazi thug, Hermann Göring, you turn it around at the end of the book that
Van Meegeren did a brilliant swindle. He was himself a bad fellow. He was in Holland all through the war years. Most of the Dutch were in desperate trouble under the Nazi occupation. Van Meegeren did quite nicely and palled around with the Germans. He was not an admirable fellow. He sells his painting, or a middleman sells it to Göring, because that's who will pay the highest price. When it all goes wrong at the end, Van Meegeren, who's terrifically nimble and clever, now makes this about-face. He says, of course I sold it to Göring. I knew. What better person to con than this great Nazi bag of wind? How could a person demonstrate his patriotism, his love of Holland, more than I did by conning the great enemy of the Dutch people? And the Dutch ate it up. They liked him.
Edward Dalnick's book about Han van Meegeren is called The Forger's Spell. Thanks very much for coming in.
Well, thank you.
To see paintings from both the master and the forger, visit our website at nbr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
This week on Morning Edition, we're meeting mystery writers who write about where they live. Today, NPR's Andrea De Leon takes us to the nation's easternmost city, where rugged coves and weathered clapboard houses provide a perfect setting for murder.
Sarah Graves' novels, all dozen of them, take place here in Eastport, Maine, an island connected to the mainland by a long causeway. Sarah Graves first traveled that causeway over a decade ago. Back then, she went by her given name of Mary Squibb. She was a commercial writer ready to ditch Manhattan. The first Eastport mystery was in her head, all ready to write before she moved to town.
I have no idea how how I expected that to happen. But I just expected that it would happen, and then we moved here, and it did. It was fate.
But like most islands, Eastport is tightly knit, its bonds made tighter by hard work and difficult weather. Then one day this writer arrives with her husband from New York. People noticed.
My very dear friends lived across the street from her, so we watched her from day one.
Mary Pottle owns a local real estate agency.
Oh, must have been something exciting over there going on. We couldn't see in the windows. New people in the neighborhood.
Someone showing up in a strange car with out-of-state plates? It sounds like something borrowed from the beginning of one of Graves' own mysteries.
The light dawned suddenly. My old book, a sudden death. And now this stranger, arriving without warning.
In the books, such a stranger would inevitably wind up entangled with Graves' reluctant sleuth, Jacobia Tiptree, Jake to her friends. Graves and her character have a lot in common. Both moved to Eastport to escape the fast life in New York, and both are fixing up old Eastport houses. Jake would prefer to spend her time glazing windows or taking a sledgehammer to the ancient upstairs commode, hence the name of the series, Home Repair is Homicide. But it wouldn't be a mystery book if someone didn't turn up dead, and quickly. And Sarah Graves wouldn't be a mystery writer if she couldn't spot means, motive, and opportunity as she drives around town.
Now we are going out to the end of Water Street, to the end of what's called Dog Island, to overlook Passamaquoddy Bay.
There's a beckoning glimpse of the Atlantic, dotted with fur-covered islands, and a view to the shoreline of New Brunswick, Canada. In any other part of the country, this kind of coastline would be buzzing with jet skis and other pleasure craft. But Graves says, not so fast.
You're completely at the mercy of the ocean if you just put one foot wrong and it catches you. It looks so pretty and so romantic. And in fact, it's just absolutely deadly. You can live about 15 minutes if you fall in. Not because you will drown, but because your body will just slow down and stop from the cold.
And as a writer who occasionally needs to kill somebody...
Works great. Absolutely.
Jake Tiptree herself almost succumbs to the icy water when she gets into a skiff with a con man named Rickert in this scene from the book Nailbiter.
Rickert swung the oar. This time the flat blade connected with my shoulder the way a bat hits a ball, lifting me and carrying me over the rail. The last thing I saw was his face watching impassively as I splashed down. Then came the sudden roar of the outboard as he motored away, leaving me in the icy water, kicking and flailing, drowning.
To read the books, Eastport seems to be a pretty dangerous place, and just like in the books, there's a big police station right on Main Street in the center of town. Anybody there? No answer. The only cop on duty is later spotted flying by Bayside Mobile, blue lights flashing. Bill Wentworth pauses at the gas pump to note the action.
The highlight of our day, some poor bugger gets a speeding ticket. Not too much goes on here.
Wentworth can't remember the last time there was a real murder in Eastport. Someone recalls a shooting that happened back in the 60s. There's a little breaking and entering from time to time. But Eastport is a place where the customers have their own key to the local breakfast joint, and they open it up to make their own coffee every morning. The town has more than its share of empty storefronts, but business seems brisk at one of Sarah Graves' favorite shops.
And here we are at Wadsworth's Hardware Store.
Wadsworth's exists in both the real Eastport and the fictional Eastport. Both Graves and her character, Jake Tiptree, spend a lot of time here.
But I have always liked this stuff. Little scrapers and little blades, razor. Of course I like little blades. Mystery writers all like little blades. Little foam paint brushes and drop cloths and... I don't even know what some of this stuff is, and I want it.
Wadsworth's even sells the Home Repair is Homicide series. The books are displayed along with the wrenches and saws in the front window. Cashier Winnie Higgins says locals love to read about their town.
If you live here in Eastport, you could say, oh, that's the city manager she's talking about. I mean, I'm just using that as an example. Because this is a small town, I don't want to get in any trouble.
Graves insists that, with two well-known exceptions, all of her characters are fictional. But nobody believes her. What they do believe is that Sarah Graves' books and the occasional tourists they bring are good for Eastport. The books feel cozy, just like the town. When Jake Tiptree isn't solving crimes, she's fretting over whether she has enough guest towels for a lady's tea, or who will help her dislodge the cast-iron bathtub she's gotten wedged in the upstairs landing.
I did once say in Jake's voice that in Eastport, when you need help, people will help you. You don't always have to be thinking about that to know that it's true, and that frees you up to count your punch cups if you need to.
The Eastport Sarah Graves ladles up for her readers is picturesque, but not picture-perfect. A lot like the Eastport you find when you drive down that long causeway to the island. Give or take a few dead bodies. Andrea De Leon, NPR News.
In 1808, women did not have the right to vote. But the wives, sisters, daughters, and friends of powerful men were able to exert some influence over the course of American life, politics, and culture. We thought that NPR senior news analyst Cokie Roberts would be the best person to ask, who is an American woman in the 19th century? Her new book, Ladies of Liberty, is full of profiles of America's most influential women. She's in the studio. Welcome, Cokie.
Thank you, Leanne. So nice to be with you.
It's nice to see you. In this time when a woman really couldn't get a formal education, although women were allowed to go into Charles Wilson Peale's museum and get an informal one, sometimes they didn't even own clothing, married women couldn't own property. What kind of influence could a woman have on politics?
Enormous influence. Dolly Madison was incredibly influential. In fact, she really ran her husband James Madison's campaign for president.
Now, how did she run it? Kind of in the tea room?
Yes, the tea room, the drawing room. They had a house on F Street in Washington, which was really a separate power base from the executive mansion. After the election was over, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, the Federalist candidate, said, "I was defeated by Mr. and Mrs. Madison. Had I just run against Mr. Madison, I might have stood a better chance."
What did learning about the women of this time teach you about the men?
A great deal, because, of course, the Founding Fathers were very self-aware. They knew they were doing something extraordinary. They wrote letters to each other that they knew would be published. And so they were formal and pompous. And the letters they wrote to women were filled with their hopes and dreams and fears and ambitions. They were much more ambitious in their letters to the women. And the women's letters to each other about them are the best of all because, you know, we think of these men as some sort of stone and bronze deities, and you can be sure their wives did not think of them that way. We see the founders as much more flesh and blood human beings through the letters of the women.
Today, it's possible to instantly see Michelle Obama, Cindy McCain, how they behave, how others analyze their behavior, their dress, how they interact with their husbands, their families, the voters. How different is it?
Not at all. Martha Washington, our first lady, understood that she would be scrutinized in every aspect of her being. When she arrived in New York, came across the Hudson to take up her post as the first lady, though she loved beautiful silks and fine fabrics, she arrived wearing homespun because she knew that for the wife of the Republican head of state, that she would have to be one of the people. But she also knew she would be watched. She called herself the first state prisoner as first lady because she was so scrutinized in everything she did.
NPR senior news analyst Cokie Roberts. Her new book is called Ladies of Liberty, The Women Who Shaped Our Nation. Thanks for coming in.
So good to be with you.
We hear about Basra pretty often these days, thanks to news from Iraq. The city was founded nearly 1,400 years ago. It played an important role in the history and evolution of Islam. Writer Muhammad Kudayir pays Basra literary homage in his new book, Basrayatha, The Story of a City. Alan Chews has this review.
It all begins with a tree. Once the date palm came into existence, Muhammad Kudayir muses, it needed an enclosure. The walled enclosure, he goes on, has to be filled with houses, and Basrayatha, or Basra, came into existence. Had it not been for the date palm, there would have been no baskets for harvesting dates. Had there been no baskets for harvesting dates, there would have been no date pickers. Had there been no date pickers, there would have been no ships. Had there been no ships, there would have been no port. Date palms and waterways. Without them, no city, and no storytellers to recite the anecdotes and histories of the civilized fort at the edge of the desert. The earliest travelers encountering Basra thought they'd found the real Eden. The truth is, as he presents it, before there was an Eden or a Troy, there were poems about them and poets. So Muhammad Khudayr is the latest in a long line of storytellers and poets who, as his poetic logic would have it, make places and cities such as Basra become real. Somewhere between history and travelogue, memoir and tribute, Basrayatha celebrates in myth, memory, and metaphor the history and vitality of Iraq's second great city. A maze of streets and alleys, markets and bathhouses, docks and squares, palm gardens and rivers, the Basra Khudayr creates is a Basra in the mind and heart, a city which, even in the wake of a devastating war, will persist and survive in the imagination of anyone who reads this evocative travel guide of the mind.
The book is Basrayatha, The Story of a City by Muhammad Khudayr. Our reviewer is Alan Chus.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.